This is NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Although the fiscal cliff saga is over for now, expect more drama ahead as more fiscal deadlines arrive in February and March. And expect to hear the same arguments from the last go-round. Politicians will call for cuts in government spending or reform of entitlement programs or more taxes on the wealthy. It's a conversation we've heard a lot of over the past year, and one that our guest today says stretches way far back to the beginnings of FDR's New Deal. We're talking this hour with Molly Mitchell-Moore, a history professor at Washington and Lee University in Virginia, and author of the new book, Tax and Spend, The Welfare State, Tax Politics, and the Limits of American Liberalism. Mitchell-Moore describes how liberals, seven decades ago, wanted to expand social programs, but understood the American antipathy to higher income taxes, so they raised revenues in less obvious ways, like the hidden payroll tax, which funds Social Security. This allowed them to accomplish their short-term goals, to establish programs they believed in, but in the long term, their approach created what Mitchell-Moore calls the paradox of American politics, our intense hostility toward taxes, coupled with our high demands and expectations for government services. Today in The Exchange, we look at this paradox and how it's evolved to the political stalemates we're still struggling with today. Let's hear from you. Do you see this contradiction that our guest sees? We want the services, but we don't want to pay for them. Give us a call, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page or on the exchange page at nhpr.org. And Molly Mitchell-Moore, good to have you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Laura. Thank you very much for having me on this morning.
Well, there's been a lot written and discussed about FDR's New Deal. We've been looking at this for a long time and how that really began the expansion of government programs. What's the untold story, then, in your book, Molly? What are you trying to tell that hasn't been told before?
Well, I think we tend to look at the New Deal in terms of the programs that are created, from the alphabet soup of the early New Deal to the Social Security Act of 1935, and to look at the ways in which government policy and government programs were expanded to help ordinary Americans. The story that isn't told as much is the ways in which New Dealers propose to pay for those programs. And my book really traces the ways in which these spending policies and politics and tax policies and tax politics have been joined since the 1930s.
Give us a little bit more on that, the way that they paid for them. It's not so we're familiar with how they were created, who they were supposed to help, but we're less familiar with how they were paid for, or as you say in the book, not paid for.
Right. Well, they were paid for, but they were paid for in ways perhaps different than we might imagine. Even at the height of the Great Depression, Franklin Roosevelt was loath to ask ordinary Americans to pay much by the way of income tax. And so most of the New Deal programs were paid for in different ways. They were paid for through consumption taxes, particularly the consumption tax on alcohol, which came back into force with the repeal of Prohibition at the beginning of Roosevelt's tenure. Social Security, unemployment insurance, these, of course, were paid through regressive payroll taxes. But unlike the income tax, payroll taxes, consumption taxes, luxury taxes, excise taxes, these don't necessarily feel like taxes. They don't generate the same kind of taxpayer consciousness, that is to say, ordinary Americans' consciousness of paying taxes, of contributing to something, as do more visible taxes like the income tax and like state and local property taxes as well, or sort of these visible taxes.
So what's wrong with that, not feeling the impact of taxes? Maybe that's a good thing, Molly.
Well, it creates a disconnect between what we pay and what we get. And so liberals created this equation, basically in the 1930s, that allowed for people, middle-class Americans, working Americans, ordinary Americans, to think that they could get basically something for nothing, to think that they were getting something for nothing. And so the liberal social compact then had this promise of economic and social security at the same time as it coupled that promise of economic and social security to a promise of low tax burdens for the vast majority of Americans.
Then you say that that the liberals in FDR's administration did this, again, because they understood the American hostility to taxes. What's that hostility about?
That hostility, you know, it is in some ways deeply ingrained in our national past, or at least our imagined national past. But one of the things to remember here, too, is that the income tax itself, the 16th Amendment, which was passed in 1913, 100 years ago, came out of popular pressure. It was the people, it was ordinary Americans that were demanding a progressive income tax. But of course, they were demanding a progressive income tax that most of them thought wouldn't affect them. And until 1942, they were right. Very few Americans paid any in income tax, federal income tax, until the Second World War.
So what happened? How did they end up starting to pay when they hadn't had to for 30 years or so?
Well, the war. And the Treasury Department did a really good job of selling the income tax as a kind of patriotic duty. The Treasury Department launched an intensive public relations campaign around a law known as the Revenue Act of 1942, which transformed the federal income tax from a class tax, that is to say, one that was paid only by the very wealthy, to what we might think of as a mass tax. They used the slogan, taxes to beat the Axis. They called in Hollywood heavyweights, Danny Kaye, Irving Berlin. They even had Walt Disney create two films, short films, featuring Donald Duck paying his income taxes for the first time.
Really?
And so this was, yeah, no, they're extraordinary. If your listeners want to go out onto the internet, they can Google Donald Duck and taxes. One of them, I think, is about 5 minutes long. One of them is about 7 minutes long. And they're extraordinary pieces of World War II era propaganda. They commissioned a song by Irving Berlin called I Paid My Income Tax Today.
I think I've heard that, yeah.
Yes. So there was a great public relations effort. And the tax was sold as, again, a war tax, as a way of bringing everybody into this struggle, this patriotic struggle against the Axis.
Yeah, taxes to beat the Axis. How lucky are they that it rhymes, right?
No, exactly. I mean, it's a great slogan.
Let me invite our listeners to join us, Molly. Again, the number on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Our guest today is Molly Mitchell-Moore, Associate Professor of History at Washington and Lee University in Virginia, author of Tax and Spend, The Welfare State, Tax Politics, and the Limits of American Liberalism. What's your take on what Mitchell-Moore talks about, this paradox that Americans want government services, don't want to pay for them, and that our politicians, both Democrats and Republicans, have done a good job shielding us from those costs? 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR is the number. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. One more time, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. And you say, Molly, in the book, just backing up a little bit from FDR and what the New Dealers hope to do, you say right up front that Americans are obsessed with taxes. That's your words. Pretty strong word and a negative word. What are you trying to say there?
I think that in the last 3 or 4 decades, the ways in which we talk about particularly domestic politics, but even international politics, often comes down to its impact on taxpayers. I also think that citizens tend to identify them first and foremost as taxpayers. I worked on Capitol Hill for a couple of years after I graduated from college, and I remember picking up the phone and talking to constituents, and whenever they would try to articulate their demands, whatever it was for, whether they were calling for a so-called left-wing cause or a so-called right-wing cause, they always prefaced that demand with, as a citizen and a taxpayer, I believe that you should do X, Y, and Z.
You've got my money. Do the right thing with it.
You've got my money. I have bought into this government. Now you need to basically fulfill your end of that contract.
And what's wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong with it, but it seemed to me peculiarly American. Particularly given what I saw as hostility toward having to pay taxes. So there's this claim then, this entitlement to power by virtue of tax paying, coupled with a hostility to the taxing power that I thought needed to be examined or explained in historical context.
Well, give us a little more, Molly, because I'm still not sure what you're trying to say there. So, again, people felt entitled because they were contributing, so they wanted something back. Again, nothing wrong with that, is that what you're saying? But it's a little bit overboard, or where are you going with this?
No, just that it seemed to be interesting. So taxpaying then has become the ways in which people make claims. So it seemed to me that that was the way in which democratic citizenship was being defined, not by voting, for example, which would be another way of declaring your citizenship, but by virtue of paying taxes. And of course, the way in which we understand tax-paying citizenship is relatively limited. When we think about taxes, we generally tend to think about these visible taxes, about the income tax at the federal level. We don't tend to think about more hidden taxes. But as we know from listening to the debate about the fiscal cliff, most Americans pay more in payroll taxes than they do in federal income taxes. But those often escape our notice as actual taxes.
So that's what you're trying to do partly with this book, Molly, is say, you know, if you're going to identify yourself as a taxpayer, look at how you pay taxes and what you get for it.
Sure, exactly. And the so manifold ways in which people contribute, that it's not just the income tax, that there are a number of ways in which the government at all levels, state, local, federal, raises revenues, and that the state then does something with those revenues, that they do, in fact, provide a whole host of services to citizens, many of which are hidden, many of which are unacknowledged.
For example, roads, schools?
Roads, schools. There has been a lot of attention in the last year or so, and I think this is a good contribution to our political discourse, about the ways in which tax expenditures, write-offs, deductions, special rates in the tax code actually do serve a kind of welfare purpose. They provide services to people. So if you look at the home mortgage interest deduction, that is in many ways or could be seen as a kind of subsidy for home ownership. But those kinds of tax expenditures usually aren't seen as something that you get from the government.
We're going to talk more after a super short break, Molly, and we'll start taking your calls, too. Again, the exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. We want your thoughts on this paradox of American politics that our guest writes about, that Americans demand the government services but don't often want to pay for them. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org, and we'll be right back.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and more on tax and spend coming up on The Exchange. At 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, serious humanitarian crisis after nearly 2 years of civil unrest. Jared Diamond, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Guns, Germs, and Steel, is our latest guest for Writers on a New England Stage. NHPR's Virginia Prescott sits down with Diamond to discuss his latest book, The World Until Yesterday. Join us at the Music Hall in Portsmouth on January 17th. Tickets and information are at nhpr.org. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from the McLean Law Firm, representing healthcare providers on a broad range of legal issues, online at mclane.com. And Granite State Candy Shop in Concord in Manchester, makers of gourmet chocolates, fine confections, and super premium ice cream since 1927, nhchocolates.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the author of a new book called Tax and Spend that looks at our longstanding antipathy toward taxes and how politicians of both sides have played into that. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477. What do you think about this paradox that our guest Molly Mitchell Moore writes about, that Americans demand and expect government services but often don't see the costs, don't want to pay the costs? Or do you think with all the fiscal cliff negotiations and conversations we've had recently that the public is a little bit more educated these days on where the money comes from, where it goes? One more time, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Molly, before we go to our listeners, just a little bit more history since you are a historian.
Of course.
Going back to FDR, and then we'll go through some of the other presidents like Johnson, for example. What was FDR's own thinking about these programs like welfare, like Social Security, in terms of who they should help and how long they should last?
Well, the Social Security Act of 1935 is often seen as the cornerstone of the modern American welfare state. And it had a bunch of programs in that one act. It had not only Social Security, which is officially called old age insurance, it also had unemployment insurance, a now defunct program known as old age assistance, aid to the blind, as well as aid to dependent children, which is the program for indigent single women with children that ultimately became AFDC in the 1960s and was replaced in 1996 in the Clinton-era welfare reform laws with TANF, Temporary Assistance to Needy Families. FDR thought that Social Security and unemployment would be permanent parts of the U.S. state. That is to say, he thought of these as his real legacy. But he thought that they would expand, and that they would expand to include all of those groups initially left out of them. So that he thought that programs like aid to dependent children, old age assistance, those programs that weren't contributory, that is to say they weren't paid for by these payroll taxes, these dedicated taxes for Social Security and for unemployment, that they would ultimately wither away when the emergency of the Great Depression had passed and Social Security programs had expanded to include different kinds of categories.
So, and of course, some of them did not wither away, and I want to ask you about that in just a minute,
sure.
Molly. But let's go to our listeners. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. First up is Wade in Hillsboro. Hi, Wade. Thanks for joining us. Go ahead.
Well, thank you, Laura. I'd like to bring this a little closer to home and say that we in New Hampshire have a kind of a almost a neurosis about paying taxes. I think that that started when we were a colony, and New Hampshire was a very poor place. You had to really scratch a living from some very poor soil, and our colonists did not like the idea of sending off their hard-earned money to a king 3,000 miles away. Now things have changed very much, and New Hampshire's a rich place. I think it's the third richest state in terms of household income in the country.
It's often among the top 10, for sure, Wade. Yeah,
yeah.
Go ahead.
And things have changed, and our taxes are not going overseas to a king. They're going to educate our children, and they're going to protect the world we live in and build roads and bridges and things like that. So I think it's time that, at least in New Hampshire, we grew up and decided this is the price of having a civilized life.
Wade, thanks a lot for calling. Boy, I love his historical analysis, huh? I mean, not
mm-hmm.
just New Hampshire, the whole country was resentful of taxation without representation. That's part of what caused the Revolutionary War.
Sure, and it's important to remember here, of course, that the country was resentful of taxation without representation, not resentful of taxation full stop. And I think this is a distinction that's important, but one that often gets lost in our national memory of our history as opposed to the actual history. Wade did mention something interesting in his comment, which is this notion of taxes being the price that we pay for a civilized society, which is actually a paraphrase of a quote from Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes. And it is the phrase emblazoned on the front of the IRS building in Washington, D.C.
Wow. Well, Wade, thanks a lot for that call. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page or on the Exchange page at nhpr.org. And here's an email that came in from Lori, who says, "Perhaps Mitt Romney did us a service by disclosing the 47%. Every American should pay at least $10 a year in taxes to have a stake in our democracy. No free lunch," says Lori. Really interesting point, and gets us to some of these more contemporary conversations, Molly.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder what you think.
Well, I think that Mitt Romney perhaps did do us a service, although he might not have done his own campaign much of a service. Although we haven't talked about this 47% and what it means for the ways in which we conceive of what the government does, and how we contribute to that government. And, of course, that 47% ignores, it focuses only on federal income tax. So it ignores the manifold ways in which those who are not liable for federal income tax, because usually because they don't make enough money, are still subject to the payroll tax, still pay sales taxes, still pay property taxes, even if they're renters. You pay an imputed property tax if you're renting, basically because landlords want to cover the cost of their property tax, so they figure it into the rent. So that 47% is a good starting point for a discussion about the ways in which we do or do not contribute and what we do and do not get back. But it doesn't take into account all of the ways in which we are taxpayers and the many ways in which we are taxpaying contributors to our government.
So that 47% referred to the federal income tax, not mm-hmm. exactly quite right. So most people do pay, as you said, payroll taxes. That's that
sure.
hidden tax again. Also property taxes in many states. They have sales taxes. We don't in New Hampshire, although we have a rooms and meals tax. So that's interesting. And Lori, thank you for that email. Again, the address is exchange@nhpr.org. The number 1-800-892-6477. I want to ask you about something on Social Security that really jumped out at me from this book, Molly. We should talk about Social Security a little more. You call it an annuity fiction. Now, what does that mean and how come?
Well, it's an annuity fiction because it isn't actually an annuity. It's called social insurance, or it's one of these programs that's known largely as social insurance, but you don't get back, really, what you put in.
Those aren't
Most
your dollars.
People, in fact, have gotten back more than what they contributed to the system. And it's not like you're putting away, it's not a government-forced savings program, although this is the way people in the 30s and 40s sold it. Social Security is paid for by taxes on current workers, right? Current retirees get benefits paid for by the taxes levied on current workers. So it's not a pension. It's not a form of insurance. It is a transfer program from one group, working Americans, to another, retired Americans.
Although, okay, so if I put, you know, X dollars in, those aren't my dollars that mm-hmm. I get back when I retire. But I have put in, Molly.
Sure.
So is that a little unfair to call it a fiction?
Yeah, because that's not how it works. And you certainly get back more than you would have put in. And this would have been even more true for the people that retired very early into the program, who would have worked 3, 4, 5 years under Social Security and then received pensions for their retirement.
So why was it created or presented anyway this way as more of a private insurance program? You put it away now, we'll give it back to you later.
Well, there are two reasons, I think, why FDR structured this program in this way. First, there is this traditional American hostility to the dole, right, to handouts. And he didn't want to create a new program that would be just another dole. It's also a way of giving people a stake in the preservation of his program. Roosevelt is said to have said to his advisors in 1939, I believe, talking about the payroll tax and the ways in which this was a contributory scheme, or it looked like a contributory scheme. With those damn taxes in there, he was supposed to have said, they will never kill my Social Security program.
Calling it a scheme, though, wow.
Well, it's not a scheme, and I don't mean that it's a Ponzi scheme and that kind of thing.
Right.
But that there is a way in which the transfer work that it does, the redistributive work that Social Security does, has been obscured by the ways in which it's talked about and by the ways in which it was deliberately mischaracterized as simply another kind of insurance. In the 1940s, for example, people in the Social Security Board compared Social Security to taking out insurance against fire or theft. But it's not really like that. It really is much more of a transfer program.
Let's take some more listeners, and then we'll talk some more, Molly. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, email exchange@nhpr.org. Bill's waiting in Hollis. Hi, Bill. Thanks for hanging on. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. Well, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a comment. One of the earlier callers, when you were talking about New Hampshire, talked about paying taxes to the king, and we were a poorer state, and people learned to, you know, fight their way and spend for themselves and so on, and didn't like spending their taxes or sending their taxes overseas. And at the end of the call implied that it's time for us to grow up and
right.
Support a civilized society.
Wade in Hillsborough,
Yeah, and the comment that I have is that it seems that assumes there's just one way to support a civilized society, and I would be curious to hear your guest's opinion on the approach that New Hampshire takes, which I would argue is a pretty civilized society. And many people choose to live here in part because of the approach we take that does not necessarily rely on some of the taxes that other states rely on.
Right.
And thank you for my call.
Well, and Bill, thank you. Yeah. And Molly, I know, in fairness, you're not a state-by-state tax expert, so I don't know how far you want to go with this. But I like that Bill called up and disagreed with Wade's point. He says, look, you know, we've been pretty successful here in New Hampshire with our low-tax model.
You know, as I said, or as you said, I really do study the federal tax code and federal tax politics, and U.S. history is an interesting and challenging thing to study because of this history of federalism, because states do things differently. And so, you know, not knowing very much about the New Hampshire model, I'm not sure I feel comfortable commenting on that.
All right. Well, Bill, thank you for calling. And again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Here's an email that came in from Mary in Manchester. She says, I've been troubled for a decade that we are at war without asking the entire country to foot the bill, as our parents' grandparents were asked for World War II. We are left not only with a high national debt, but veterans returning to joblessness and homelessness. Mary asks, why didn't we raise money to fund our decade of war? Can you address that again? I know the book is more of a history from FDR up to Ronald Reagan, but can you talk about how the costs of war have sometimes been put off budget?
Sure. Well, we didn't raise taxes to pay for the war in Afghanistan and in Iraq, largely because the Republicans were in charge of Congress and George W. Bush was in the White House. And in fact, Tom DeLay, who at the time was majority leader in the House of Representatives, said on the floor of the House that the best thing that we can do in the face of this war is to cut taxes. But the Republican Congress and the administration of George W. Bush were not the first administration to try, as you said, to put a war off budget. In the 1960s, for example, Lyndon Johnson, a good liberal Democrat, passed a huge tax cut, a 20% across-the-board tax cut in 1964, at the very same time as he started to wage both a war on poverty and to ramp up American involvement in Vietnam. And so there is then this history of trying to have your cake and eat it too, to basically hide a war by not paying for it.
Wow, a 20% tax cut.
Mm-hmm.
That's huge.
Yes.
At the same time, he's putting in this giant war on poverty and a real war in Vietnam.
Yeah. And the idea, of course, was that this tax cut would be stimulative, that it would grow the economy and that tax revenues would actually go up as a result of this economic growth, that the taxes had gotten too high during the Eisenhower years and that the economy needed a little bit of juicing in the 1960s.
So here you have a Republican, Eisenhower, raising taxes, and then
mm-hmm.
you've got Lyndon Johnson, a Democrat, cutting taxes. How did he pay for the war on poverty and the war in Vietnam at the same time decreasing taxes 20%? Did that revenue bump happen? Did the lower taxes stimulate growth that brought in more cash for the Treasury?
It did initially. It did in 1964, 1965, and a little bit into 1966. But ultimately, the economy got too hot in 1966 and 1967. That is to say, inflation, the cost of living, started going up too fast. And so in 1967 and then again in 1968, Johnson was forced to go to Congress and ask for a 10% income tax surcharge. This was supposed to be a temporary tax hike. It wouldn't change the rates. It would just add 10% to whatever rate was already in there in order both to cool down the economy, to tamp down inflation, but also to offset the cost of the war. And this was a huge political defeat for him because it was a moment where he was forced by Congress, and particularly by Democratic conservatives in Congress, men like Wilbur Mills, who was the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee for most of the 1960s, for all of the 1960s and much of this post-war period, to choose between guns and butter. And so in 1968, he had to choose guns, sacrificing in many ways this war on poverty, which he was very committed to but couldn't sustain.
So Congress made him do it, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Humiliating
yeah.
for a man who prided himself on knowing how to manipulate Congress.
Yeah, and this, you know, 1968 was not a particularly good year for Johnson. He was forced
right.
By New Hampshire to drop out of the presidential race in March of 1968. And so there was a lot of eating crow for LBJ in 68.
Well, and odd words for me to hear on the radio, I have to say, the economy got too hot. It's hard to imagine anybody saying that these days, but we'll leave that as it is for now. And take another call. This is Kathleen in Peterborough. Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, good morning. Thank you so much. Molly, I just wanted to clarify one thing, and then I have a question. You had said 3, 4, or 5 years and get Social Security, but you need X amount of quarters in order to qualify of earnings.
Originally, they changed it.
Pardon?
I'm sorry. I'll answer after you're done. Go on.
And then some people, you're saying get a lot more back. Some people just die, like my brother did at just about 55, with a lot of money going in, never got a cent back.
Yeah.
And my question is, where do you feel on raising the cap, the $110,000? Is a lot of pushing down on workers' status and the wealthy accumulating more?
You know, Kathleen, first of all, sorry about your brother. That's a tough road to travel. And, you know, despite Kathleen's difficulty, most people are living longer and longer, and so that's causing more people to dig into the Social Security system. But go ahead, Molly. Did you want to jump in there? And then I have another question.
No, I think Kathleen actually raises a very interesting point about raising the cap. The ways in which the payroll tax works is you only pay the payroll tax on income up to a certain level. And I think it's about $108,000 or $110,000, which basically exempts any income above that level from this payroll tax.
And what's the thinking behind that? And when did that get started? Has that always been the case, Molly?
Because
that's interesting.
That's always been the case. They have raised the cap. You know, they've raised the cap various times over the history of Social Security to reflect increases in wage, but that has always been the case.
So the thinking was everybody buys in, so it will be less politically controversial? Is that why they have that in there?
Why they have that cap in there?
Yeah. Why?
You know,
and
I'm actually not that familiar with the reasons why initially they put the cap in. But that would be something that I should certainly look into.
Well, there's a lot in the book without that. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Kathleen, thanks for that call. And we'll take more of your calls and emails after a very short break. So stay with us.
This is NHPR, where support comes from UR members and from Heritage Plumbing, Heating, Cooling. For any plumbing, heating, cooling, or drain problem, offering annual tune-ups and efficient heating systems, online at justcallheritage.com. And the Symphony New Hampshire and conductor Jonathan McPhee, performing music by Brahms, Stravinsky, and Mozart on January 19th in Nashua. Information and tickets at symphonynh.org. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
The legacy one leaves for a community can last for generations. I'm Anna Moskoff, Plan Gifts Officer at NHPR, and I'd like to talk to you about the many ways in which you can support NHPR, like leaving a gift through your estate. You can make a lasting impact on this new service for the next generation of public radio listeners in New Hampshire. For more information, please call 800-639-4131 or visit the support page at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, your questions and comments about the new health care exchanges that are coming under the Affordable Care Act. You can email us before the program if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. And be sure to join us tomorrow morning, live at 9. Today, we're talking with the author of a new book called Tax and Spend, looking at how politicians from both parties have tried to hide the true costs of government spending, leading to, she says, some of the fiscal struggles we see today. Join us. Do you think that Molly is right, that the American politicians have largely tried to hide the cost of government services? Or do you think that these days most people do understand issues of debt, deficits, taxes, where the money comes from, where the money goes? Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. And Molly, let's go right back to the callers. And John's waiting in Gorham. Hi, John. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Just a couple points, and I'm not hearing mentioned, but I think it's important to understand prior to Social Security, and this goes to some of the reasons for it, the elderly as a group were the most impoverished group in the country, and they were literally unable to sustain themselves. We had a lot of poor farms throughout the country, and that kind of addresses that. My second point is, in terms of Social Security, I'm on it now. Most of my latter working career, the last 15 or 18 years, I tended to pay the maximum. Usually I paid it by September or thereof, and then they didn't continue to withdraw it. And according to a friend of mine, I tend to get almost three times what many people get for Social Security. There go, because I paid a considerable amount into my lifetime. So there does seem to be a nexus between how much you pay in as opposed to how much you receive in benefit. And I do agree that much of our public do not connect our taxes with the services that we get and that are necessary. And for example, in New Hampshire, one of the callers alluded to our system, but also keep in mind that our tuition for our students to our state universities is the highest in the nation. So there is a connection, and I think that should be understood. And I guess that's all I had to offer.
Well, John, thank you very much for calling in. And he's so right. I mean, before Social Security, the elderly were impoverished. What about his point that, you know, to some extent, you do get more from Social Security if you make more?
Sure. No, it is a contributory program, and so benefits are attached to contributions. So those that have put more in over their working lifetime, those who have earned more over their working lifetime, have gotten more back. Their benefit levels are higher. There is some redistribution within the program, largely to bring up those people at the very bottom of the income scale into a kind of a level of not comfortable retirement, but possible retirement.
Go ahead, Molly. Do you want to say more there?
No, I was just going to say that it's not, you know, it's not a strict relationship between then contributions in and benefits out, that there is some redistribution within the system.
You know, we talked earlier. Oh, and by the way, thank you for that call. We talked earlier about some Democratic presidents. You mentioned Johnson in the book. You mentioned Kennedy cutting taxes. You mentioned Eisenhower raising taxes. Today we see a flip of that, Molly. Democrats are painted as the party as more comfortable with taxes. Republicans are considered the party of tax cutters. Did that start to happen around the Reagan Revolution, or when did we see that shift?
It actually starts earlier than the Reagan Revolution. I think it's probably more accurate to see Ronald Reagan's election in 1980 as a resolution to a long-term historical process rather than a kind of revolution. The GOP decides in the mid-1970s that it needs to become the party of tax cuts, largely because it'd been on the outside of national politics for so long. And so the GOP takes the advice of a Wall Street Journal columnist known as Jude Winiski, who was an early acolyte of supply-side economics, to become the so-called Santa Claus of tax reduction. The transformation of the GOP into this tax cut party begins then in the 1970s, but it's not completed until the 1990s, when GOP revolutionaries led by people like Newt Gingrich look at President George H.W. Bush's signing of the tax hike in the early 90s as a kind of apostasy, as a kind of a rejection of what they think of as core Republican beliefs. And they set about purifying the party on tax matters.
So prior to the mid-70s, Republicans not necessarily in that mold, Democrats not necessarily in that mold.
Yeah, and you see a change in the lineup between ideology and partisanship beginning in the mid-1970s. The Democratic Party was, of course, not a purely liberal party for most of its existence, in part because the leadership, at least, of the party and the leadership of the party in Congress was made up of old-school Southern Democrats, most of whom could not be considered liberals in any way.
So that purification on the GOP side, are you saying we've seen that now on the Democratic side?
Well, it happens to both parties beginning in the 1970s, largely because these conservative Southern Democrats leave the Democratic Party largely over the issue of civil rights beginning in the 1960s. So this is a different kind of purification. It's not kicking people out necessarily. It's people leaving.
Because they feel uncomfortable.
Yes. With the party's stance on civil rights, yes.
You know, one more question about Reagan, and then we'll go back to our listeners. Now, he cut taxes. He was famous for that.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't he raise them again later? Am I wrong about that?
He also raised them later. He raised them, in fact, I think 5 or 6 times.
Wow.
During his 8 years in office. So the big Reagan tax cut comes in 1981.
Early on.
And this is very early on. And in fact, if you want to think about the Reagan Revolution as a revolution, it's a very short-lived one. It lasts about a year. The tax and spending cuts in 1981 are the height, in many ways, of the Reagan Revolution, at least in domestic policy. But Reagan was concerned, or at least his advisors and many Republicans in Congress in the 1980s were concerned, about deficits. And so in 1982 and in 1983, they passed a number of deficit-reducing measures that include, they didn't want to call them tax hikes, so they called them revenue-enhancing measures. And then, of course, there was the famous and comprehensive 1986 tax reform bill, which raised revenue without raising rates. It eliminated a lot of loopholes in the tax code, which meant that the federal government could bring more in at the same time as it was actually cutting tax rates.
Yeah, well, they're talking about that now, eliminating loopholes instead of changing rates. So Reagan felt reducing deficits ultimately was more important than low taxes.
Well, people around Reagan or the general, you know, Washington, D.C., Congress, parts of the administration were concerned enough about deficits that they were willing to raise some taxes or pass some revenue-enhancing measures in the early 1980s.
Let's go back to our listeners. And Frank is waiting in Bedford. Hi, Frank. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes. Good morning, Laura.
Morning.
Just before I make my main point, I don't know if you're aware, but the first person to head Social Security was appointed by President Roosevelt. He was a 3-time New Hampshire Republican governor, John Gilbert Winant.
Oh, of course, Frank. I had forgotten about that. Yeah, go ahead.
My main point is from Andrew Carnegie, who was a Republican and a multi-billionaire by the time he died, who said money earned from society should be returned to society. And he favored giving back to America a lot of the money that was earned by people like himself. And if you look at something called the carried interest loophole that Mitt Romney wound up paying 13% taxes, and when he takes his $1 million deduction of the Mormon Church in the next 3 years, he will have paid 9%. A fellow named John Paulson, who heads the Paulson New York hedge fund, makes $23 million a day. He pays about 12% taxes.
Because of loopholes and deductions and stuff?
Last year. And if we get rid of the carried interest loophole and made the truly wealthy, and $23 million a day is pretty darn wealthy, if we get rid of that, we'd raise another $45 billion a year for the U.S. Treasury, or almost a half a trillion in the next 10 years. But for some reason, Congress doesn't want to ask Mr. Paulson, who makes $23 million a day, to pay what the average American middle-class person pays. We pay about 23% in taxes after. And that's making $50,000 or $60,000 a year. We pay over 20%.
Okay, and Frank, I'm going to jump in here and let you off the hook a little bit, Molly, because again, you're a historian, not an economist. But boy, some of the themes that our caller raises, and thank you, Frank, for calling, do echo in your book. You know,
sure.
This idea that the rich should pay more, that it's not fair.
No, and in fact, the federal income tax itself comes out of this populist and popular anger, this sense that the rich were getting away with paying very little.
And were they?
They were paying very little. In the late 19th century, the economy changes in significant ways, and people are rich in really different ways. So it used to be that you were rich if you had, well, basically if you had a lot of land, right? You'd have a lot of real property. And so therefore, the property tax worked to target the very rich, to get revenues out of the very rich. But in the industrial age, wealth isn't real, right? Property isn't real. And so there was a question as to how do you tap this new kind of wealth? How do you tax stocks? How do you tax bonds? How do you tax profits. And so the income tax comes out of this popular anger that robber barons like Andrew Carnegie, like John D. Rockefeller, were making millions and millions of dollars and paying very little back. At the same time as ordinary folks were facing tough times and were facing relatively high taxes, indirect taxes in the form of the tariff, which was the substance of 19th century finance. And it basically raised the cost of consumer goods for ordinary people. So the income tax then is a popular tax. It comes out of a popular demand that the rich pay their share.
So Frank's feelings today very much echo what we've seen in the past.
Sure, yes.
And are they justified today? Or were they justified in the past? Sounds like you're saying those feelings were justified in the past.
They were justified in the past, and they may certainly be justified today. There are a number of ways. We talked about the ways in which both Democrats and Republicans historically have wanted to both hide taxes, to raise taxes in invisible ways, but they've also wanted to hide spending. And so one of the ways that you can hide spending is to do so through the tax code. And so the provisions that Frank is talking about, this carried interest deduction, is basically a way of subsidizing investment. But you get to do it through the tax code as opposed to through the budget, through actual spending.
Well, thank you for that call, Frank. Good points. And again, thanks for reminding me about New Hampshire Governor Wynette. That's a great historical note that I had forgotten about. You know, we talked, Molly, about the Reagan Revolution and how that started us on this path of seeing the parties becoming more conservative for the Republicans, more liberal for the Democrats, this hardening that we talk about so much today. I want to talk just for a minute about Bill Clinton, because he kind of frustrated those in both parties. He came shortly after Reagan, you know, not 4 years after Reagan. Obviously, we had George Bush the first after Reagan. He seemed to sort of adopt a lot of Reagan's talking points. Government's the problem. I'm going to lower your taxes and so forth.
Yeah, he did.
End welfare as we know it. Remember that?
And ending welfare as we know it, cutting taxes on the middle class. If you look at the campaign imagery of Clinton's first campaign in 92, it actually looked very much like Reagan's campaign in 1984. There is this Morning in America theme that comes through his positioning in that 92 campaign. But certainly he was trying to attach himself to or to use the Reagan appeal, this appeal to the middle class taxpayer, and to use public antipathy toward welfare. Welfare is generally the term we use to describe a very small slice of federal spending for the very poor, to indicate his frustration shared by the middle class with the inefficient ways in which the government is supposed to have been spending money.
Yeah, and it worked for him.
It did work for him. And, of course, the economy worked for Clinton in the 1990s.
I want to ask you, and again, I know you're a historian, but I just have to ask this anyway, Molly. So forewarned is forearmed, okay?
Sure.
Given this long history that you've dug into, you know, looking back at the parties and how they've talked about taxes and how they've tried to hide the true costs of the programs that they have promoted, both Republicans and Democrats. Given this history, how hopeful are you watching these fiscal cliff negotiations that will be coming back again when the debt ceiling is getting approached again? How hopeful are you that Congress and the president will be able to reach some meaningful agreement about these fiscal struggles?
Well, I wouldn't say that I'm terribly hopeful that there's going to be any kind of long-term grand bargain in terms of bringing taxes and spending closer into line with one another. Now, I'm not saying that we need to balance the budget right away. And obviously, the economy is still fragile, and raising taxes and cutting back on spending right now, I think, is a bad idea. Again, I'm not an economist, but my sense is that this would not be a great move to do right now. But I can't say that I'm too hopeful that in this next round there's going to be any kind of long-term solution to the problems struck, that there will be no grand bargain at the moment. But when historians make predictions about the present or about the future, we're almost always wrong. So that you may take heart in that little fact.
Well, what from history makes you feel that way?
It's not so much history, although I suppose the development of the GOP over the last 30 to 40 years and its adherence to this anti-tax hike ethos, this anti-tax hike ethic, I think makes it very difficult for them to strike any kind of bargain with regard to revenue, because it's not for them a political problem. It's a kind of existential problem. If they raise taxes, then they are no longer the tax cut party. What then does that do to their brand? What then does that do to the party?
And you've done, again, looking back over time, this evolution, that makes you feel the way that you do.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see what happens with the predictions. We promise not to call you up and say you were right or wrong, but it's been really nice to talk to you this hour.
Fantastic, Laura. Thank you very much for having me on.
Thank you. Molly Mitchell-Moore, Associate Professor of History at Washington and Lee University, author of the new book we talked about called Tax and Spend, The Welfare State, Tax Politics, and the Limits of American Liberalism. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our interns are Faith Meixel and Laurie Zibel. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoi, and tomorrow on The Exchange, the Granite State gets ready for what are called health exchanges under the Affordable Care Act. These are new marketplaces where consumers and small businesses can shop around for health coverage. Advocates say these will encourage competition and lower costs, but there are many unknowns, including who will regulate the insurance companies that participate. Email us at nhpr.org and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show, next at 10.